Namaste. In every culture, there is a talk about forces that oppose the march of mankind, whether individually or collectively. So we are on Collected Works of the Mother, Volume 6, 1954, and there is a very interesting topic that she touches upon. Everything is interesting. But one of them is about the four asuras. So, who are these asuras? Who are these opponents of God? Apparent enemies of God. Why are they allowed? What role do they serve, if any, in the scheme of things? So there are different ways of looking at them. One is that they are shadow of God. So why does his shadow fall? Much the same way that when something obstructs the sun, you have the eclipse. And earth's shadow, as we say, or the moon's shadow falls upon the earth because it obstructs the sun. And why are they allowed? Now, shadow is one way to look at it. Mother speaks about it in a very beautiful way, that these are the four aspects of the divine. We talk about three, sat, chit, ananda, but chit is chittapas. In other words, there is truth or knowledge. And there is consciousness, chit, and tapas is force, and ananda, bliss. So in the course of creation, as these forces moved further and further away from the one, but always carrying the one within their heart and always surrounded by the one. Now this is a subtle mystery. What is meant by moving away from the one is the sense of separation. There can be no real separation ever. So if you look at it from the point of view of the one, there is no separation. Whatever darkness there may be, the one is always there. So he calls the last shot. So from the divine point of view, there is no separation. And hence he can take this plunge into apparent inconscience, because he is still there. And we all in that state have agreed to this plunge into inconscience or creation, call it whatever way you look at it. But from the point of view of the forces, the first four emanations, that is knowledge, or rather truth, then consciousness as knowledge or consciousness, and then force, tapas, and ananda. Force also life, tapas, that force that moves this world. So these are the four original forces, and as they moved to create, each was given his own freedom to create. And so in the beginning, each of them created while being in contact with the divine. They were referring to the cosmic manager, time, and beyond the cosmic manager, they owed their allegiance to the one who is beyond time. But as they moved further and further, they developed this sense that we are omnipotent, because naturally each of them carried a tremendous amount of power and tremendous amount of knowledge, strength, might, whatever we may say. And so this sense that we are as if the original creator, they were supposed to be the intermediaries who were supposed to transmit the original will and build forms or worlds out of that. But as it happens that if you are too close to the prime minister or the president, you may think that you are just the same. Whatever you do, the president is bound to sign it. The prime minister will ratify. Until one day you discover that it is not so. And that day sometimes people even turn away in revolt, because they had taken for granted, and they turn away in revolt and they wander far. And they think that all this that they wielded was their own power, but as they go further and further, they discover nobody cares for them. Their care and their importance was only so long as they were in the office of the president. So this is what happened to these forces as they turned further and further in revolt against the one will, because now they want to create what they feel like on their own. So they took it for granted that whatever we create will have the sanction of the Supreme. But as they went further and further, they lost contact with that original will. They started having their own worlds which they created, and eventually, because they lost contact with the One, they lost all the power, energy, knowledge, which Ananda, which they were carrying. And because they lost all that, they turned into their own opposites. Meaning thereby, truth became falsehood, sat. Knowledge or consciousness became unconsciousness. And force or life became death. Death is what? A state of utter helplessness. And Ananda, bliss, became suffering. Ananda or love became suffering. So this is the change which took place in them. And since then, creation hangs between these two states. On one side, there is behind us, as creation is being pulled out of this state of unconscious, by the action of grace, by the power of divine love. We are not going into great details, because that would be a subject in its own right. On one side, there is this inconscience and the four great asuras which want to pull it back. On the other hand, it is being pulled up by this original four forces, four gods, if you may put it. We have already spoken about it, infinite existence of Brahma, infinite consciousness of Vishnu, infinite force of Shiva, and infinite bliss or Krishna. So now there is this tussle. In between, we see that many of these four asuras have given rise to several titan kings and many of these asuric beings. On the other hand, the four original gods have given rise to several gods. And this is the battle between the gods and the titans, which we hear in the Puranas, the Vedas, and several other places. And where is the battlefield? We are the battlefield, and earth is the battlefield. And why they want to possess earth? Because earth is the place where consciousness is emerging through an evolutionary process. And so whoever holds earth, he has the mastery. All the elements of creation are found on earth. So both the asuras want to conquer earth, master earth, and the gods also want to snatch away this earth from the hold of the asuras, because then only the real work can be done. Asuras in the beginning are far more powerful. Why? Because creation is emerging from them, so they are holding it tightly. And what emerges first? Matter. So their hold is greatest on matter. Material catastrophes, human body built of matter. So they have a tremendous power they exercise over matter and things built of this physical matter. On the other hand, as evolution of consciousness has developed life and then the mind, mind onwards, we see the gods have a greater hold. And life is midway. So life is a field where the battle takes place. On one side, the asuras, they don't want life to emerge out of matter. They don't want it to grow. On the other side, gods also have an impact upon life. So in most human beings, practically it means that in yoga, the battlefield is the vital. The vital of man is the battlefield between the gods and the titans. Mind can be afflicted, but higher mind onward, generally these forces cannot do much damage. And lower vital, onwards, downwards, the gods cannot help much. They can, but the fight becomes very crucial. So this is the background. So what happens to these asuras? We have these traditions. The Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Vedas speak about it. So they are killed and we celebrate and they come up again. They assume new forms. So they are like the head of the Hydra. So is there a solution to it? And first time in the spiritual literature, first time, we see that there is a solution. There is a plan behind it. And that's what Mother and Shobindo revealed to us. So first, why they've been allowed? They've been allowed to make this creation more and more perfect. So that we don't, in a hurry rush, abandoning everything else and believe that we are perfect simply because deep inside we have discovered the perfection of God. So even the body must be perfect. They give a tough fight. Vital must be perfect. So they point out the smallest defects. That's why people who are constantly pointing out defects are under the... I need not say more. So it's the task of the adverse force. Let them do it. Whereas there are people who are always bringing hope, light. That's the part of the gods. So we should play the part of at least of the gods. Always bring light, hope, strength, beauty in creation. And what do the asura do? See, this is defect, this is wrong, this is bad. Now they have their purpose. What is their purpose? They end up making things more and more perfect. But gods make it perfect in a different way. They point out the beautiful possibility, and the demons point out, the titans point out the imperfection or the difficulty. And they exaggerate it beyond measure. So therefore, because they've been allowed, because they ultimately, though they, because of them, time takes very long. That's what everybody grudges. But the work is also more perfect. So what happens to these asuras? So the mother, in one of her very interesting commentaries, several places she's spoken of it, and as I said, we are reading it basically focusing mainly from the book. But it's a very interesting story. Maybe we can talk about it some other time. So the mother is asked, she speaks about these four asuras, and she says that there are six creations which have been dissolved ultimately because these asuras would not allow it to go to perfection. But this is the creation of equilibrium, and this is bound to eventually escape the law of the law of pralaya. So then there is a question somebody asks. Then what is the position of the asuras? She says to be taken back into the divine. See, divine cannot disown or abandon anything or anyone. But she elaborates. There were four great asuras. Now we have it in our mythology. They have fallen from the heights. It's not described in such elaborate detail, nor their ultimate destiny described, nor their impact upon human beings and earth. All that is not described. We look at it as an event taking place in some period of time. But if that was the only thing, it would lose its meaning. But it is an event which is going on in creation, this great battle. That's why there is that attraction towards it. So out of the four, two are converted. She'll tell us which ones. They are taking part in the divine work. So they are not only converted, not only are they taking part, at one place mother says a converted asura is a far more useful instrument for the divine than an innocent angel. So a converted asura who has taken the fall, plunged into the darkness and has emerged out. The other two are holding out well. How long will they hold out? We shall see. What a confidence. We shall see. So, they have the choice between being converted, that is taking their place poised in the whole totality, or else being dissolved, that is being reabsorbed into their origin. So why is mother allowing so much time? For a simple reason. If they choose to be converted, all the humanity that depends upon them will have a good destiny. And if they choose to be dissolved, much of humanity that depends upon them will be dissolved. It's like withdrawing the oxygen from people's life. So being the divine mother, she is letting them have their own time. And she knows that ultimately, and asuras also know, ultimately who will call the last shot. There is one of them who has almost completed, attempted conversion and not succeeded. When it had to be done, it seemed to be to him quite unpleasant. So he has put it off till another time. Mother gave human forms to some of these asuras so that they can change. But when they take a human form, they feel very limited, suffocated. So they don't like it. That's one, because they can exercise a lot more power from above or below, whatever way you want to put it, from outside the human consciousness. Yet they want the human consciousness. This is a paradox with the asura. They want to take a human body because human beings have that extraordinary power in them that attracts them, because human beings have the divine presence which they can become conscious of. And they know that this is what, if we get this parasmani, then we have the alchemy stone. But at the same time, if they take a human body, it casts an influence upon them which they don't like. Because the moment you touch a human being or enter into that, the psychic will start putting pressure. So this is their problem. As to the, for the other, he refuses to try. He has taken up a very, very important position in the world because people who don't know things call him Lord of the Nations. There was a book which had come out by this name, by the way. Figure out who had written. Okay? In fact, I was speaking a while ago about the forces which govern the world and don't want to give up their rule at all. They are perfectly satisfied with it. It is not that he does not know that his end will come one day, but still he always postpones it as long as he can. But as they do not have human dimensions, it can go on for quite a long time. This is their position of the asuras, she has explained to us. So then, the disciple wants further clarification. So she says, speaks about these four aspects and how they become their opposite. And then she says that who is converted? The first, that is the consciousness which has become unconsciousness. That has got converted. Light or consciousness became darkness and inconscience. Love and ananda became hatred and suffering. And truth became falsehood and life became death. Well, it is the first two. That means consciousness, which has become unconsciousness, and ananda, which has become hatred and suffering. These two have got converted. So, one of the things that nowadays everybody talks about, growing conscious, becoming more conscious. And this is the door through which darkness enters. One is unconsciousness. Second is falsehood. So actually, hate, suffering, love for suffering. So these are the doors, the sense of weakness. All these are doors through which we see the asura enters. The first is, but not exactly in the same conditions. The first is converted and works, but he has refused to take a human body. He says it is a limitation in his work. So, but he has said that one day I'll probably take a human body. That means consciousness became unconsciousness. But he is now agreed to convert, so more and more human beings will become conscious. Conscious of their aspiration, conscious of their soul, conscious of the divine, conscious of, you know, all this play of force. They'll become conscious. Because this person was throwing a cover. He was making people unconscious. So now because he has accepted conversion, now we will see whether you like it or not, human beings will become conscious. And this is what we see happening in the world, which is so strange. Why suddenly we see? You see, people were just doing things mechanically. Now they are doing it with a sense of awareness. The second is converted and has of his own will been dissolved. Hatred, suffering, they have chosen to dissolve. He has dissolved into his origin, and the last two are holding out well. The one of death tried to incarnate, but he could not get converted. One of them was, of course, we know, mother's teacher of the dark occult mysteries, Theon. Max Theon was the asura of death. So he tried, and he could have remarkable knowledge of many things. Because that is another kind of knowledge. You know, death covers it all things it covers, but it knows itself as far as it is concerned. That's why at one place Shobhinda says, "Oh Yama, take me from mansion to mansion." But it makes us completely oblivious of our own inner sources of strength. That is the way death operates. So, this is where the mother said that he tried, but he could not get converted, but in 1970, almost 14 months after the descent of Superman, she said that death has been shot. So this fellow is now going to, you'll see its impact slowly. Mankind will begin to refuse the inevitability of death. And slowly it will find ways and means through which one can overcome death. This is bound to happen because though, as he has said, that there are many, many emanations which continue to work, like when you cut off a tree even from the root, still for a long time you will see it, its flowers, you will see even the trunk and the branches, but slowly they dry up. And the fourth is falsehood, and she says that he has refused completely, but he has said one thing, that I know I have to be converted, because you will call the last victory is going to be yours. But before I get converted, I'll create as much havoc as I can. This asura governs this falsehood which refused to be converted, governs politics and business particularly. So you can see he holds the power. So, but now, when you look at the world politics, especially within a certain setting, in the Indian context, for example, you get an impression that this asura is also now, because now, see, all over the world actually, now politicians try to hide certain secrets which are very dark, and we always thought of they are very nice. But since 90s, all their things are getting known to the world, as if truth is acting on falsehood, or we can say falsehood is getting converted into truth. So whatever is hidden, it cannot remain hidden. So we can see that more and more, and it is creating a strange situation. But even politics and business world will begin to change. And one can see the first glimmer of dawn in these two also. So then she says, one good thing about asuras is that they fight amongst themselves. It's the nature to quarrel. And she says, just like men who are under asuric influences, they are the worst enemies among themselves. The lord of falsehood has truly a lot of influence. This is what catches you with a contagion so strong as that of contagious disease, stronger still. And then of course he says that sometimes they take a human body, and in recent examples of Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, the asura had almost incarnated. Not exactly, yet strong influence on Hitler. Stalin possibly was an incarnation, partial incarnation. Mussolini, so these had, and even now on human beings, they have a strong influence. And there are hallmarks of these asuric beings. They want to destroy all that is true, all that is eternal, all that is beautiful. And now you see they are openly speaking about it, at least in India, which is a sign that he is feeling a pressure. So he is blurting out the hidden truth. So now they are openly challenging all that is true, beautiful. Recently in India we have those politicians spoke about we must destroy Sanatan Dharma. This is classical language of the asura. And it also exposes them to that extent. Now human beings, whether they will side with them, as very often they have taken side of the anti-divine forces, or they will take side of the divine forces, will decide their fate, because ultimately no power can stand against the divine will. But it is up to them. If they go with the forces of falsehood, the undivine forces, they will be destroyed, because it's the history. You see, Itihas, Ramayana, Mahabharata, Second World War. People say, oh, Ramayana, Mahabharata are way back, but see the Second World War. Ultimately, truth wins, conquers. This is a, of course, when you start saying my truth and your truth, then you're not even looking into truth. Truth wins. This is a history of the universe, is that truth wins. So, but it may take some time, it may do a lot of damage, but human beings have to decide. So in many ways, when we talk about, since it's the election season, election is not just about parties. It's not about my freebies and your state and this. Elections are also about which party is more aligned towards the truth of things and which is not aligned. Now I am not giving any suggestions. Left to people to see through the masks, see through the promises and discover for themselves which is more aligned, because ultimately truth will win. This is something we must always remember. So this is a big subject, as I said. I don't want to go into its great details. Then there is a very interesting subject on the gods and human formations. So we often have made images of gods and we have idols of gods. So someone asked the mother. She said, no, most of them are as seen on the vital plane. Invariably, if the number of arms you will see, you can understand that they are on the vital plane. That's where, you know, even in vision, if you see a Devi with eight hands, or they are on the vital plane. Now they may be good or bad. They may, most, many of them may be, benevolent beings, but we take them for the highest. That's where we make a mistake. So we are so fortunate. That's why I keep telling this also on WhatsApp messages. I must remind people on Saraswati Puja Day, we'll put up that Saraswati image. Please, you can use the mantra, is fine. But these images belong to the vital world. Divine Mother has given her darshan on these days. Why has she given the darshan? We should try to understand that. Because now she has put out that aspect through the Supreme in a human form. That should be more than enough. Not only more than enough, that is the best way. She has put something of herself, for at least for us. Not that we should convert anybody or try to teach this teaching to anyone. But as far as we are concerned, that's how it is. So these gods and goddesses on the vital plane. And then she says, who has suffered the worst of these deformations? She says, Kali. And that you see when you read Sri Ramakrishna, he speaks about Kali as golden color. And same thing Sri Aurobindo also says. Golden color and otherwise that, that kind of blue, which is very different. It is not this at all. And she says it's completely on the lowest possible plane they have brought Kali. And since human beings invoke her, many times it's not the real benevolent goddess of intense love who comes. Of course, the action is same. Out of intense love and rapture, she slays all the difficulties, and more than slays, she takes you leap across big loops of time, because she has that tremendous power. But if you invoke this other one, then it's like a senseless destruction which may take place. And that's why this invoking Kali, then people sometimes invoke Kali for somebody else. Please be very careful. If at all you want to invoke Kali, do it for cleansing yourself. Because if you try to do, Kali should come because injustice is happening elsewhere, she will first inflict you. So the mother says maximum distortion has taken place with regard to Kali, and we know that she has her own experiences of the Kali of Virampatanam, and all these are interesting stories. She speaks about crores of Kalis and different types of Kalis. She has a whole, almost, because she herself embodied that power that changes time. If you read in Savitri, there is a whole description of Kali when, at the moment of death, when Satyavan's soul is taken out, then she surges out. And when you read that description, a violent will, rapturous will, and she guards Satyavan like a treasure in her deeps. You will feel that what Kali can do, and she can snatch you out of the jaws of death. And there to seek her help, intervention, in times of your crisis is alright, because she is a world mother. But to seek her because you feel somebody else has done something wrong, then first she will rip us apart and show us all that where we have been wrong. So she describes that very beautifully in great detail. And then something very interesting. In two places she speaks about ascetic disciplines. In ashram, when people come, this is one thing they don't understand. Because they want to see sadhus in sadhus dress. And they don't see. So they wonder, ye half pant wala kaun hote hain? Kuch choga to pehne, kuch some robe, some kind of robe. Sannyasi's robe. So why they don't find? What about some ascetic practices? They should get up at 3 o'clock, do some kind of so many hours. They ask sometimes, what are you doing? And if you say we are opening to mother, oh, okay, that's, no, tell me what you are doing. They don't understand opening to mother is a full time occupation. So someone asks, mother, doesn't ascetic discipline help us to overcome attachment? Page 301, very valid question. We should stay away, ascetic discipline. We will not meet people, will not be together. And mother says, no, it inflates and strengthens your pride. So she looks through the depths of her. So she explains it very beautifully. But doesn't some outer discipline help? Mother says, if you impose a discipline upon yourself, and if it isn't too stupid, it may help you. By too stupid, you mean there was one he was a disciple. His name was Radhananda, if I am not mistaken. So he had imposed such a discipline that he'll close his eyes when he came out. Why? Because if he sees girls and women, he may have a problem. Ashram girls, so some of them used to have great fun with him. When he would walk, they would suddenly put their langda tongue in front. And he would stumble and open it, because he was forced to open his eyes. People who used to do it told me once. You know, they used to do this. So, some people have tried this. Mother says it doesn't work. It only inflates your pride. There was another story of a Himalayan yogi who came here. And everybody, oh mother, he's such a, you know, he meditates. It would be nice if you had disciples like him. Mother just smiled. She didn't say much. And when he went to the playground for meditation, he couldn't meditate. He said, all these women, girls are there. They are wearing, you know, normal clothes, not indecent, normal clothes. How can I meditate? But those of us who grew up here find it very natural, normal. We don't think in those terms. A girl is sitting next to you or girl is there. But they cannot, because all that remains inside. You see this, there was a very beautiful movie called Chitralekha, based on this fallacy of the ascetic. But she's saying if it helps you, it's fine. It's your business. A discipline, I tell you, disciplines, tapasyas. So of course, she's using the word tapasya in terms of external discipline. Not the true tapasya which she has spoken of in volume 12, and we'll speak about it elsewhere. All ascetic disciplines are, as ordinarily practiced, the best means of making you proud. Of building up in you such a terrific pride that never, never will you be converted. It will have to be broken down with hammer strokes. And it is so true. When you take to this yoga, everybody has tried some kind of outer discipline and felt very proud about it. And when you come, she, acha, you are a good guy. Okay. Shivinda at one place says, if you are not ready to become ordinary of the ordinary human being, you will not be able to practice this yoga. Because all this pride that we carry and we look down upon others condescendingly, and this inflation that I am, all this gets broken in the, that's the action of truth. You have to change. It's not, she is not saying indulge. But this way of external discipline, that is not the way. So what is the way? The first condition is a healthy humility, which makes you realize that unless you are sustained, nourished, helped, enlightened, guided by the divine, you are nothing at all. This is the important thing. To be constantly turned toward the divine. Who is constantly turned toward the divine? Person with humility. Not puffed up with, I am a sannyasi, I am. And sometimes they can harbor very dangerous impulses because they have just put it down within themselves. So the mother was never in favor of people going and meeting sannyasis, etc. But if you have the humility, first lesson here one learns, let me put it like that, is you learn the lesson of humility. That's why when people would come to the ashram, first thing the old sadhaks will say, just stay on, hold on. What should I do? What they want to do? Meditation? No. Just stay on. Develop roots. People think, what is stay on? I have come. Some people have the money. They have agreed. So what is there to stay on? Then you realize that there is every effort to uproot you and not many can stand it. I know people who come with great enthusiasm, but somehow they cannot stand this pressure. Because you have this image creating. These images will break. And if you want to create images, this is not the place. Because nobody will bother. You will pass by people and nobody will know that you are even engaged in something called as yoga. Why? Because it's an inner process. It's not done to show off or to show to others what you are doing or not doing. It's happening within you. So this is why she says, first lesson is, and you are given so many, I use this term, that first thing that the Divine Mother teaches us is dhobi pachhad. You know what is dhobi pachhad? Dhobi pachhad is you pick up and you wash the cloth. So how do you wash the cloth? You pick it up and dash it against the rock, stone. So what happens when you do that? Lot of dirt goes out. What does, so the cloth may break, but then the dhobi is holding it. The washerman does not let go of the cloth. He lifts it again. Ah, nice. Once again you feel the touch of the washerman. Next, dhobi pachhad. So this yoga, one of the practice, dhobi pachhad. If you go and learn judo, martial arts, the first thing you are taught is how to fall. Not that you have to fall deliberately. But if you try to put up a show and sham, you will be given sufficient number. She will not stop. Till you ultimately say, okay, mother, you alone are there. This idea that I am someone, I am something, gone. When all this is gone, you are emptied of all of myness and I-ness. Then she says, okay, my child, come. You are ready. Now I can fill myself into you. So that, so we should not forget the asana we do here is dhobi pachad asana. Okay? So, and that also we don't do. She does it. She puts us in the washing machine, takes us out, and then after applying the soap of her love, that time we are very happy, huh? Soap of her love is being applied, and she puts us again in the waters of divine love. That time very nice. Then she lifts and on the stone, dhadak. You feel, kya hua? Everything goes out. Then again she lifts. Then when you are gone through this process, then the sunshine of grace and everything gets dried, you come out cleansed. But that time if you say, I am clean, okay, come back. You need another round of cleansing. Just to be healthy humility. This part she elaborates at one more place, which I want to read. Several places she has said it. And it's important to understand that yoga can be best done in the normal circumstances of life. And that's why in the ashram we see that there is nothing externally. No outer discipline. She says that we have here a great freedom. But there is a very exacting inner discipline. And she says that you are tested, your sincerity is tested at every step. You won't realize. And she says that it's not the big things on which you fall. You stumble at the slightest stones. She says, just like a gadi is going at a big speed. You see a big rock and you divert. But you have those little pebbles, you will stumble. So she says that here in the ashram, we don't have any external, we have given freedom. But you have to be careful and conscious, and at one point you do become conscious. And that's how you have to. I remember this story of learning scooter on the tarmac Air Force. Somebody, very simple, you hold it and drive. See, she is very good and you'll drive, and he sat behind us. Very good. And you enjoy because it's, nobody will come there. And then suddenly I fell very badly. Why I fell? Because there was a very thin layer of oil which I didn't realize. Because you don't notice it. He told, if you see something, you can apply brake, and I'd learned, but you don't notice these slimy little things which are waiting for you. Luckily, mother's grace, nothing happened. Either to me or to my instructor. But then this is how one learns. So one should not, one has to persevere. Be very patient. Here we are not there to become someone or something. Here we are there to forget this someone or something and be just her, nothing else but her. Then she's asked again at another point of time, mother, for self-mastery, are not the ascetic methods useful sometimes? See, disciples don't give up because they'd all learned these things. Once in the playground, they had played one music. And that music was the French music when soldiers are going for war. So the girls are singing for them. So one of the persons went and complained to mother, what has happened? See mother, they played this kind of music. So mother said, what music? And she said, what's wrong with this music? Because they, you know, we are used to, they must play some bhajans and something like that. She said, it's a very beautiful thing. It's, now she is not giving a sanction for this or that. She is simply pointing out at the person's limitations. We should not turn it into a dogma that we can play anything or everything. She is reminding that, look here, if you can receive everything with the right consciousness and you can see that spark of divine, that something of that beauty of human love which is ready to sacrifice, and we of Indians should understand it. When you read like Shurbindo, that Ulupi's episode with Arjuna and Mahabharata, you see there are so many touching moments and they're all one single spiritual theme, or Rama's. So later on we have developed this division of life between this is spiritual and that is not spiritual. Everything can be turned into and seen and received and responded from a spiritual standpoint. But what ascetic does, he cuts life into these two halves. And that's what she is reminding us. So, aren't they useful sometimes? Mother says, no, you cure nothing. You only give yourself the illusion that you have progressed. But you cure nothing. And I have seen this. There are people who sometimes, no names, they will take great pride that we don't go out and ever have food somewhere. But sometime when there is aloo puri or something, even in dining room, look at it, you know, with all that tiffin and everything, oh, today there is. So you have actually cured nothing. It's all there inside you. And even if you don't develop that, you have dried up sometimes possibilities inside you. So she says, it cures nothing. The proof is that if you stop your ascetic methods, the thing is even stronger than before. So you have to maintain it by a very forced way. That I will eat only this, I will touch only this. Why? Because if you, the moment you come out of that zone, you collapse very badly. So, it comes back with a vengeance. And then she says, it depends upon what you call ascetic methods. If it is not to indulge in satisfying all your desires, this indeed is not asceticism, it is common sense. You are not supposed to be indulging your desires. He makes that difference. It is something else. Ascetic methods are things like repeated fasting, compelling yourself to endure the cold, in fact, to torture your body a little. See, the Gita says the titans torture means because they know me not in the body. Torturing your body, sleeping on the mat or bare this thing, putting a pillow, not pillow, brick below your this thing, and feeling very proud that, you know, we don't even use mosquito net if mosquitoes are there. Dilip Kumar Roy wrote to Sri Aurobindo that I have decided, Guru, that my vital things are very bad, out of shape. I can't handle them, so I have decided to become a sannyasi. Every few months he will do this. And Sri Aurobindo says he gets into those moods. So I'll wear the ochre robe, I'll shave my head, and I'll eat only this, I'll not indulge in tea, rasgulla, all this list he writes. So I hope you will ultimately feel proud when I come in front of you. Shubhendu says, I would be horrified to see, a bald headed Dilip with all the mosquito bites on top of it. Because that is not curing you. You don't need to torture your body that way. And prove a point. Some people want to prove a point. I never take medicine. Okay, don't take medicine. It's a nice thing. If necessary, take it. Don't make a fuss about it. Don't make a big show about it. Of all the things, there is this pride that all my life I have never taken medicine. All right, good, you have not taken. Point is none of these things. Point is, have you realized the divine? That's the only thing. Nothing else. How, which way you do it. And for that, pride is a big obstacle. So to remember the divine, and then these desires, all these things automatically drop. This indeed gives you only a spiritual pride, nothing more. It masters nothing at all. It is infinitely easier. People do it because it is very easy, it is simple. Just because the pride is quite satisfied and the vanity can get puffed up, it becomes very easy. And if you are not married, nobody is there to tell you that you are being vain. That is a big problem. You are very satisfied, I am good. Unless somebody is there to tell you that, look here, you know, you are indulging in vanity. Or a good friend, but good friend don't want to break their friendship by pointing out. So, this is something that has been known for centuries. Sri Krishna speaks about it in the Gita. You look at Lord Rama's way of life, you'll understand. It's there, known for centuries. It requires a much greater quality not to be attached to the things one possesses than to be without any possessions, or to reduce one's possessions to a strict minimum. It is much more difficult. It is a much higher degree of moral worth. So she now gives us the secret. Simply this attitude. When a thing comes to you, to take it, use it. When for one reason or another it goes away, to let it go and not regret it. And this applies at every level, from physical objects to human relationships and everything. not to refuse it when it comes, to know how to adapt yourself and not to regret it when it goes. So this is the attitude for the yogin. This exactly we see the Gita also speaks about it. For those who are in tradition, somehow, somewhere ascetic practices became so much hyped in Indian culture. That's what I call as the dark ages. And even today, somebody living in a mutt, did Sri Rama start a mutt or did Sri Krishna start a mutt? Even Sri Aurobindo says, I am not here to create mutts or a sannyasi. There is a letter of his. And he says, I am here to call the souls of the strong to the Leela of Krishna and Kali. And Siddha Ashram, by no standard it is a mutt. So this ideal was never there in the true spirit of India. Somehow it came in and unfortunately it is continuing. So that's where we have to be careful about. And she says about it, even about Ashram, that living here is not enough. You have to ultimately understand and practice it this way. You may live here for all your life and it doesn't matter. She says all this very categorically, that you have to make this change. Then there is something very interesting she speaks about, which is very relevant for all of us. We want to keep up social relations. Now, social relations are not friendships. Social relations are relations based on, well, social things. We know that certain kind of, you are born with some, then you have family, you have all kinds of families and relatives, all those things. Sometimes you keep up, even in friendship, it turns into a social relation, social gatherings, partying together. She says there is a great weakness in social relations, a very great weakness. And that is why, in fact, one gets angry and gets carried away and says things one should not say. If one were not weak, one would never be violent. So this is not so much about social, but about violence and anger. Weakness and violence are two things that go together. He who is truly strong is never violent. We know this. When we read Ramayana, we see it. That Ravan, boastful, and all those Rakshasas, Asuras, even Meghnad, quick to anger. But when we see Rama, he is all quiet and peace. Though he is the mightiest of the warriors. Until date, actually, if you see, there never been a warrior greater than Ram. Nobody, Arjuna, anyone. When you see, that's why Sri Krishna says, among the warriors, I am Rama. Because never has been a greater warrior. And yet, very quiet. This is something one should always remember. Violence is always a sign of weakness somewhere. Now we can understand that where is the problem with many. Why? Because they want to show that they are strong. And they cannot, unless they project that they are strong, do something outwardly. Because they are very weak people. And therefore they meet their nemesis. Their story, their end is written in the way of their life. Because when you continue with that, you become weaker and weaker, hollow. You collapse under your own weight. He who is truly strong is never violent. Of course, one sees a man with bulging muscles who is very strong, knocking down another with all his might, and one says, he is strong. Mother says, it is not true. He has muscles, but morally he is very weak. So, he may be strong here and weak there. Usually, this is what happens. And then she gives the example of, look at the animals, world you will learn. Agitation, violence, anger, all these things are always, without exception, signs of weakness. So if people are prone to anger, we can understand that, well, there is a big weakness inside. And very simple, they cannot contain the energies that come. They need to burst out. They cannot hold. There is life. That's why it is an incontinence. Whatever comes, they must blurt it out. They must speak it out. They must express it in some kind of anger. It's an incontinence. It stands on the same level like sexual incontinence. So this is where it's a lack of continence. Without exception. And especially when one gets carried away in one's speech and sees things one should not say. This indeed is the sign of a frightful mental weakness. Mental and vital. Frightful. Otherwise, you may hear all the insults in the world, People may tell you all possible stupidities. If you are not weak, you may perhaps not smile outwardly, for it is not always good taste to smile. If somebody is insulting and you keep smiling, it may irritate very badly. It doesn't serve a good purpose. It can sometimes disarm also. But deep within you, you are smiling. You let it pass. It does not touch you. So she says that even if somebody is insulting you or something, you should that time go inside. Don't project yourself on the surface and start responding to those vibrations. You have that story of Nalinida, whom one woman caught on the road and said all kinds of possible things. Nalinida kept quiet, heard for 10 minutes or something. Then he says, Shesh hoye gelo? Are you done? And then he walked away. It is so interesting. Are you done? Okay, you have finished out, you have blotted out. Okay, bye bye. I'm going. It requires a tremendous yogic mastery. So, and then she speaks about how we can strengthen our will, and she says it's like exercise. People say they have a weak will, but it's because they have never taken care to cultivate it. See, even today in our school, there is no such thing as strengthening the will. Whatever happens is very indirectly. That there is a discipline, at least external discipline, that you have to go for classes, you have to wear a certain dress. That's the only thing. Now even that is not there. So this aspect of will is never trained. And how will it end now? Because children are provided with all kinds of comforts. At least one generation before, there was no choice. So your will was, by its very nature, you had no choice but to strengthen your will. It was not like, I like to do it, it's pleasing to me, because life was not like that, organized like that. So now life is organized in such a way. So that's why the ancient system of Gurukul had a big advantage. So sometimes people ask, is it better for children to be with the parents or be in the hostel? Now it depends, of course, but mother always used to say with parents, they pass on their atavism, their shadows, their habits and their ambitions. Yes, they care and protect the child like nobody else. But the problem is there also is that they overprotect. So the child never gets to see the challenge. Now with Guru, if he is a good, obviously as I said, you can't be throwing a child in the hostel given. Hostels are also now commercial places, they take money, they provide you all the comforts, AC rooms. So it beats the purpose. But what was in Gurukul? So at 5 or 7 the child went there. And the Guru was a truly a benevolent being. He was, you know, not only master psychologist, he was a spiritual master, he was a master of human psychology. His wife used to be full of compassion, who would organize and arrange things. And then when children, but they can't fuss like they would in their home. So you had no choice. Like I know in a hostel, we had a time, 9 o'clock at night, 10-year-old, I studied in a hostel. So 9 o'clock used to be our study time. At 9 o'clock, who wants to study? I mean, talking of those days, bulbs are also so this thing, not like today. But we had to go there because there will be a sister sitting there with a, so we would go there. Of course, we found our own way of playing book cricket quietly, opening the book and, you know, I don't want to teach it. But at least this idea that you have to be there in time, you have to finish your things, this was at least ingrained. You had no choice. You can't tell it at home that we are going to throw you sat. Teacher would make sure that you have finished your food. You can't be wasting it. So there are things which you learn. And in Gurukul, of course, it was a far greater thing. So if there could be masters like that, or at least in a hostel, people who can warden, who can take care, it has to be by limited. Ashram hostels are the best in that regard. Because there are not too many children. And hostels are named not by the name of those who take care of the students. Which boarding are you? Bebidi is boarding. Which boarding are you? Charudi is boarding. Which boarding are you? Minudi is boarding. Like that. And it's like they become family. So they will take them even for the cinema, bring them back. They allow a certain degree of freedom, but these also watch ashram hostels. I have not seen. If that kind of hostel is there, then it is best. But of course, we are very far from this. So if the choice is between Parents and hostel, given the way hostels are, yes, parents still provide the best alternative. But a day should come, because children, when they stay at home and grow up, it is also true that in many ways, that strengthening of character, unless they get very good sanskar, their parents themselves are ideals who are following a life, then you will pick up many things. When they see that parents are leading a life of some ideal kind, then children pick up. But such parents are very few. Everybody is in a race of money and ambition, so they pick up all the wrong things. And in the name of freedom, drinking together, some parents feel it's cool, it's a wonderful thing. So we have to, hopefully, coming age, we'll have more and more such places where children can study and stay there as part of a Guru Grahavas. And perhaps that's how one day we'll have schools, not the way it is now. She speaks about after death, we come to the end, but something very interesting. After death, she says, just one little thing I'll read and then read the last bit. So, she speaks of after death and she says that last moment aspiration is very important. Of course, we know it. And she says that instead of clinging to the person or letting the person cling to you, you should remind the person of their own highest aspiration. And this is what our attitude should be. Not crying, not clinging. Oh, what has happened? Oh, doctor, try this, try that. Instead, we should let them go peacefully. Remind them of the mother's presence in the heart or the divine presence in the heart. Put some nice music so that they can be in their highest aspiration. That's the best way of saying bye-bye. The most important thing in this case is the last state of consciousness in which one was while both were joined together. That's the vital being and the body. So the last state of consciousness, one may say the last desire or the last hope or the last aspiration has a colossal importance for the first impact the being has with the invisible world. So this is so practical. And here the responsibility of the people around the dying man is much greater than they think. If they can help him to enter his highest consciousness, they will do him the greatest service they can. But usually what they do is to cling to him as much as they can and to pull him toward them with a fierce selfishness. Because you are going to face the loss, not realizing that he is happy. He'll forget after a little journey. He is going to get a new body. Maybe after a little journey, he'll be very excited to be in the lap of the divine. Why do you want to hold him back to the sphere of sorrow? The result, you see, is that instead of being able to withdraw in a slightly higher consciousness, which will protect him in his exit, he is gripped by material things, and it is a terrible inner battle to free himself from both his body and his attachment. I have seen one death, several deaths I have seen, very interesting. Sometimes people in coma, they get rid of their last attachment. But one death particularly I remember, somebody who had cancer and it had spread, and so I was involved in that terminal phase, and some people had requested, so I would go and talk. There was nothing. He knew all about it. He knew it's cancer. He knew it is spread, but he used to remain very calm. Mother's devotee, in fact disciple. He never, as far as I remember, never became an ashramite, but he worked selflessly all through in the, but he was regarded as an ashram inmate. And whenever, first time when I went, I saw him reading the newspaper, and I was not sure whether all this SIT spread of cancer I have heard. So I just broached, yes, I know, they have told me. And then he would divert his mind. He would watch the TV news, and he would also, of course, do his reading. Last day, when he was in a very bad state, he was admitted. So I asked him only one question. Well, a lot of people had come outside who wanted to meet. Not lot of, but few people, but all closely. So I said, anything you want, because he said, I'll now sit and meditate. I knew that he is going to withdraw. 6 p.m. in the evening. He said, I don't want anyone to come and see me. I asked your wife, he said, nobody. Then he sat. He sat, and he sat, and he sat. At 1 o'clock he left his body. And that time somehow, night, sister got somewhere, she just went to see. And at that point of time, suddenly she saw him droop and departed. And I had to convey this to the family. It was a bit odd. He does not want to meet anyone. It's a very odd thing, no? Somebody would, but I could understand that. Well, he wants to now detach himself. Such a beautiful exit. So with this, we come to the end of the book. On 31st December, this is interesting, the mother makes a prediction. 31st December 1954, and she used to give a message. So New Year message of 1st January 1955. She gives the message, no human will can finally prevail against the divine's will. Let us put ourselves deliberately and exclusively on the side of the divine, and the victory is ultimately certain. And she says, makes a prediction. She says that the next 14 months are going to be extremely difficult. And people asked her what we should do. So she says also what we should do. Just one moment. She's asked, Mother, why not 12 months instead of 14? Ah, that, my child, you may ask. Well, there are people who believe in the stars. They will tell you, ask the stars. It is like that. Why do you take a certain number of years to grow up? So she has seen something she doesn't want to explicitly say. So the disciple asks, Mother, will it be difficult for the ashram or also for India and the whole world? She says they are interconnected. The world, India, the ashram and individuals, everyone, according to his mode, usually not in the same way for all. So the person asks, if this year is difficult for us, what should we do? Mother says, what should you do? She is going to manage it. She then laughs and says, be very good. Mother's sense of humor, she says, be very good. Very quiet, work well, be very obedient, do what you are told and be regular at school. Laughter. All this is very important. And then the disciple asks, if we succeed in these 14 months, Mother, then after that, will it be easy or will it be as at present? Mother says, if during these 14 months you make much progress, you become very good and very reasonable, very conscious and very regular, after this it will be much easier. But if you spend your time in letting time pass without making any progress, you will find yourself in the same position where you now are, not better. Then she explains, it is precisely a chance given to everyone to make progress. Difficult hours come to earth to help us take a leap. If he doesn't use it, so much the worse for him. This is the kind of period now going over the world. He will remain where he is. And instead of being a conscious element in the world, he will be a cork upon the waters, tossed by circumstances. And with anything that happens, he will be carried away without having the least control over what is happening. Because the first thing necessary to have a control over events is to be absolutely conscious and master of oneself. That's why she says that the hour of the God is often terrible. It's like a tempest. It can carry you away. God knows where. But if you hold on and be as good as you can be, it will pass away and you will have progressed and things would be better. You must not think that suddenly it will be a beatific paradise where all your defects will disappear as by magic. It is not like that. Your defects will disappear if you do what is necessary for them to disappear, not otherwise. Here we are, my children. I think that's enough. 31st December 1954, exactly after 14 months, the supermind, the supramental manifestation took place on 29th February 1956. Exactly 14 months later on. Chairman.